Yes, and we're talking about an optimist tour of the future with Mark Stevenson, the author. And we'll be back with Mark in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Mark, let's get into some of these items that you've been working on. Tell me about this underwater cabinet meeting. What the heck is that?
Yeah, that was bonkers. That was one of the best parts of the trip. I loved that bit of the book. I wanted to go and see somebody who really knew about real politics, as it were. I've been talking a lot about innovation, and I wanted to go and see somebody who knew, you have a lot of techno optimism, scientists or techno geeks will go, everything's going to be solved by technology, we'll be fine. And I wanted to go and see a few people who, dealt with the real world, in inverted commas, for want of a better phrase. And so I wanted to go and see a man called Mohamed Nasheed, and he is the president of the Maldives. And the reason I wanted to go and see him was because he's a guy who really understands how to move from somewhere that is terrible to somewhere that is good. Because a year before I saw him, he was a political prisoner. He had been in jail, I think, 16 times, in solitary confinement for 2 years at a time. The previous dictator, they beat him to the brink of death twice. They put laxatives in his food. They put him in a cell that was designed to heat up like an oven in the South Indian Ocean. It was brutal. And now he's the first democratically elected president of a nation. So I wanted to go and see somebody to say, how did you get from somewhere that's so terrible and so dark to someone that's where you are now, where you're the president. And then also to talk to somebody who is a president, has to deal with the day-to-day. And he has a big problem of moving his country forward because the previous regime had meant a lot of the tax dollars had gone into, and I'm not kidding here, gold-encrusted toilets at the presidential palace to people. That's great. That's James Bond villain type stuff. If a gold-encrusted commode doesn't say, I'm a self-serving, whatever, what does? Exactly. So I wanted to see this guy. And also because the Maldives is one of the lowest lying nations on the planet. There's not an island out of their nation that is more than 6 feet above sea level. And therefore, they're very worried about climate change and sea level rise. So I wanted to talk to him about, how he views that and what he's doing about it. So I wanted to see him talk about all these things, but I was also invited as one of four people that wasn't in the government to be in this underwater cabinet meeting, which was basically a PR stunt for them to get international coverage to draw attention to the fact that they're worried about climate change and sea level rise. It got huge coverage, and it was the world's press was there, and it was just one of the most bizarre events of my life because I'm basically in this crystal clear blue lagoon. I'm underwater. There's, I think, about 15 or 16 government ministers, all in scuba gear, all signing a document that's being passed around. And, it's the first time I think you'll ever see a whole meeting, dressed in tight-fitting rubber. And it's not something to do with the English aristocracy. And it was just quite incredible. I ended up swimming back to the shore with the president, and I was next to him, and he gave me the underwater hand signal for, "Are you okay?" And I responded with the hand signal for, "Yes, I'm okay," because there isn't a hand signal for, "Oh, my God, I'm an underwater cabinet meeting in the Maldives. How cool is that?" So that was pretty cool. And, he's very, very good at that. He's in the process now of turning his country carbon neutral because he thinks that's a good example for everybody else. And I did ask him, I said, "Look, how do you move from a place like you were to becoming president, and also a place where you're a tiny nation, which is under threat, as he sees it, to a place of positiveness?" And he said, "Well, always by imagining that there's a better future. It doesn't matter how dark it is, if you can keep hold of the idea that it can be better, then that gives you the wherewithal to move out from those dark times." I mean, he should know. I thought, this guy was tortured to the brink of death twice, and is now a complete optimist. I think it was very instructive. He said, "Thoughts are real. They become material quite quickly once you've had them. If you can believe something, you can make it happen," which again, I think is very American dreamlike in a way. And it's certainly something I believe, getting a book deal, for instance, is not the easiest thing in the world, but you say, "Look, I can do this." And then, if you really believe it, and then you tie that to your intellect, you can really make things happen. I thought he was a great example of that. And I say underwater cabinet meeting, as one of the best moments of my life. The Maldives is not a bad place to hang out for a week, I tell you.
I love it. Now, tell me about your meeting with George Church. He's the one, of course, who launched the Human Genome Project.
Yeah. He's an extremely fascinating and important man.
What does he see in the future?
Well, what he's trying to bring forward now is something called personal genomics revolution. So he's doing this incredibly interesting project called the Personal Genome Project. So the Human Genome Project basically has, well, Craig Venter has said this, it basically has told us nothing in that, in terms of therapy. We can sequence our genomes, we can look at them and go, okay, we've got a bunch of data. But what we don't really understand very well at the moment is how your genome, your genetic code, interfaces, interacts with your environment. So why is it that your sister gets colds but you never do? You know, why did Uncle George die? Was that because the heart attack he had was always something that was in his genetic code, or was it because he worked in a laundry and ate mustard sandwiches and that had some kind of interaction with his genetic code? So what George is doing at the moment, this is one of the things, two particularly interesting things he does, but this is he's sequencing the genomes of 100,000 volunteers. And then he's asking them a bunch of deeply personal questions about their health, their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He's taking their medical records, and they're going to track them for, you know, over a period of years. And the idea is that you will be able to eventually go, okay, if you have this genetic marker or whatever, then bananas are bad for you. That's why you're getting ill. You know, so stop eating bananas because there's an interaction between your environment here and you that's making
something you probably never would know.
Exactly. And the thing is, we don't know these things at the moment. But by sequencing enough people, and as sequencing gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, we'll be able to do this. And the idea is that one day we'll all have our genomes sequenced. And if we want to, we can share that information with our doctor. And a really good thing about this is, at the moment, we have this absolute treasure trove of life-saving drugs that we don't use. And the reason we don't use them is because even though they might cure or help 99% of people, quite often they will be dangerous or even fatal for 1% of people. So this is why the FDA is incredibly cautious, because you can't have a drug that has 1% failure rate, right? You can't kill one out of every 100 patients. Okay, but if you have your genome sequenced, you may be able to look at that data, look at the drugs on offer and go, okay, you 99 people can get this drug. You have to have another one, you have to have a combination of a couple of other drugs, because this, you know, the normal one will kill you. And what that means is the price of drugs could start to get really low, because at the moment, drug companies, there's only 1 in 5,000 drugs makes it to be approved for human use. So drug companies have to cover the cost of the development of all the drugs that don't make it, the 4,999, in the one that does.
That's
which is
right.
Why this is why they're so expensive. If we will have cheap genome sequencing, we can suddenly have an avalanche of life-saving drugs that we already have. But that does require us to have, you know, say this cheap genome sequencing. And the good news there is the first human genome costs something like $3 billion. To have done. So $3 billion by the publicly funded effort, and then Craig Venter spent another $100 million, I think, on top of that. Now there's a man in Harvard called David Weitz who thinks he's worked out how to do a human genome for $30. That's a massive advance in just 11 years. So this leads to the idea that in the future, you and I could have our own personal medicine where we can walk into the doctor, and also your kids can walk in and they can go, you know, looking at you, Junior, you really should avoid, peanuts, or don't eat bananas and peanuts in combination, because that's going to have bad stuff for you, bad implications for you. So you get to stop having diseases because you can change your environment in advance. So I think that's absolutely fascinating, and it could see. There's a huge healthcare debate in the States, as you know, going on, but it could start to see a lot of healthcare get a lot cheaper if we invest in this technology. And I think, you know, that move that he's making. That study that he's doing is one of the most important studies in medicine at the moment, and could genuinely revolutionize the way we interface with our health. I think that's absolutely fascinating.
It could make people live until they're 200 years old.
Well, I mean, this is another debate, and I cover this in the book. You know, if we all start living longer, I mean, we are doing. Let's face it. If you go back to 1911, okay, worldwide, the lowest life expectancy was in Bangladesh, and that was 22. Okay, so. The average lifespan is 22 in Bangladesh. That's in 1911. Now I think Bangladesh is at something like 59 or something like that. But the lowest life expectancy now on the planet is 44 anywhere. So we've doubled life expectancy in the last 100 years, you know, from the very base level. And the 44 is in Afghanistan. Now, war-torn, troubled Afghanistan has a life expectancy twice that of what Bangladesh did 100 years ago. So you're seeing us living longer and longer already, and we're already beginning to have these debates about what does that mean for the pension system? What does that mean for our politics? What does it mean for, you know, politicians wanting to get votes? Because in all of that, they're having to attract, you know, older voters, which they weren't thinking of, you know, 50 or 60 years ago. So this does have massive implications, you know, and there are some good things. I mean, personally, I like the idea of having a long, healthy life. But what does that mean for
us? If it's prosperous for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so how does that work out? And how do we get the good? How do we get the bad? Because one thing we know is that medicine isn't stopping. And actually, none of us really want it to. If you say to people, you know, and I often ask this question when I'm doing talks, okay, who here thinks we should continue to battle disease and, you know, the fight against cancer, so on and so forth? Pretty much everybody puts their hand up. I mean, some few people don't, but I would say on average, 90, 95% of people put their hand up and go, we think it's great. We think doctors are great. We think the whole medicine ethos is fantastic. And then you ask them, who here thinks that people should have the technology available to them to live to, you know, 150, 200, 300? And pretty much everybody puts their hand down. And the problem is, I think it's kind of the same question. As our medicine gets better and better, we start to live longer and longer. For instance, there's a lady called Caitlin McNamara, and she's an example of a woman who's wandering around the United States right now with a bladder that was grown for her in a laboratory from her own stem cells to replace the diseased one she already had. So she's got a brand new replacement body part grown from her own tissue.
And she's fine.
She's fine. Well, I mean, she's got some other problems as well, but her bladder's absolutely fine now.
They'll replace those too, whatever they are.
Well, exactly. The Wake Forest Institute of Regenerative Medicine in North Carolina is currently growing 22 types of human tissue in the laboratory. So this leads to the possibility that in the future, if one of your organs packs up, you can have a backup having been grown for you.
What about a new heart? Can you make a new heart?
Well, this is a great question. They're working on that. I can tell you that there was a study, I forget exactly where the institute was now, where they took a rat's heart and they stripped it of all the cells that it had on it from the donor rat. So it's basically just a collagen shell. And then they sprayed it with the right kind of stem cells. These stem cells grew into a heart around it, and it started beating.
That's amazing.
I mean, that is amazing. So again, massive ethical implications here. This is why I wanted to write the book, because these changes are happening. We need to guide them in a positive direction. You're not going to stop them from happening. So what decisions do you make as an individual, as a company, as a nation? And therefore, everybody needs to know about this stuff, which is why I wanted to write a book that was readable by everybody, but was really accurate on what's happening. So I'm not trying to say you need to do this, you need to do that, but I do think you cannot make any kind of decision unless you're informed. And then currently, the level of information we get out there is often quite difficult for us to get hold of. So the book is a primer on all this stuff: robotics, genetics, synthetic biology, and also there's a bunch of jokes in it. And you know, you get to see me in rubber at an underwater cabinet meeting as well. So you know, you get breaks along the way.
How far out into the future did you go?
That's a very good question, because I started off with the idea that I would look at my lifetime. And I kind of figured, well, maybe I'll live to 100. And I did, there's a bit at the beginning of the book where I kind of go through, okay, I'm looking at all these things about people living forever and all these technologies. But I make it kind of like a fairly reasoned judgment. So, you know, well, let's assume I'm going to live to 100. So I thought, I'm going to look at the next, 60 years. I'm 40 in a few weeks. And I thought that was pretty reasonable. By the time I got to the end of my journey, some people were saying to me, the pace of innovation is so much that all the things you've looked at are going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years, because the pace of innovation keeps speeding up. So again, I'm not really sure how far I looked. What I'm saying is, these are the trends, these are technologies that are going to change the way we live and think about the way we live, at least get informed. So to be honest, could be 20 years, could be 100. Some of those technologies probably will come to pass very quickly. Some of them may not be for a while. But that's not really the point. I didn't want to set a timescale on it by the end of it. I was just saying, hey, you know, here's the stuff. Take a view.
Robots. Tell me about this. What's going on there?
Have you noticed that they've been coming forever? Have you noticed that?
Ever
since the 1950s, we've been expecting them to turn up and be cleaning our dishes and, you know, we'll have a robot like they did in the Jetsons.
In the Twilight Zone?
Yeah, they just haven't turned up. Have you noticed that? The best we've got is a Roomba.
Yeah, but they're coming.
Well, yeah. And
what about robots that can lie?
Well, we've got robots that can do something. Well, we're beginning to get robots that can do something called the false belief test, which means they can understand that you believe something different to them. But this is, I've got to be very careful here, because as soon as we talk about robots being intelligent, people immediately leap to like the Terminator or the Matrix and go, oh, it's all going to be terrible. Right, they're going to take us over. We're a very, very
long way. And make their own little robots and attack us.
We're a very long way off anything like that. And actually, I came to the conclusion that we really don't have to worry about our robotic overlords taking us over. One of the things that I mean, one of the reasons that robotics, in the sense of them being sort of sociable, useful, friendly creatures that we've imagined in science fiction, coming to pass, is because, well, Steven Pinker makes this point very eloquently. He says, when it comes to robotics, we've learned that the easy things are difficult and the difficult things are easy. And by that, he means that it's relatively easy to get a computer to beat Garry Kasparov at chess. Okay, I mean, it's not really easy, but it's pretty easy. But it's very hard to get a robot to recognize a face or walk across a room without hitting an obstacle or, you know, do anything that an animal could do, find shade, you know, go and plug itself in, that kind of stuff. And it's because as human beings, we actually find those things difficult ourselves when we're born. And we take a long, long time to learn how to walk. You look at a child walking, it takes, you know, it makes thousands and thousands of mistakes. Natural language, learning to speak, you know, we make thousands and thousands, and we still do, you know, as any underestimated president will tell you. You know, we have to go through this process of learning in order to become fully functioning, sociable, intelligent human beings. And what robotics has now realized is, if you want to create a robot that does that, you have to take it through the same learning process. So now, where I went to the personal robotics lab at MIT, they're putting human beings and ordinary human beings, not robots, at the center of the research, bringing them in and going, how is this robot reacting with a normal human being? Does the robot understand the human being? Does the human understand it being the robot? Are they using the same social cues? And I must admit, I saw a robot while I was there that, it sort of shrugged its shoulders when it didn't understand something. It cocked its head to one side. It blinked occasionally like human beings do, even though it didn't need to blink because it's got cameras for eyes. But it made me think, okay, this is a machine I can get on with. And I think the general trend is very good because a lot of technology we battle with, I don't know about you, but I've sometimes, you know, I'm cursing at my mobile phone or my computer because it just doesn't get me, you know. And I'm going, look, how can you be so stupid? Look, of course I want to save this document.
Can you imagine how slow they used to be, though, Mark? We couldn't live with that speed anymore.
I know. But now, with this idea of sociable computing and sociable robotics, it might be that our relationship with computing starts to, or technology becomes to be a bit more like friendship, where your computer will get what you want by the tone of your voice or the fact that you're shouting at it and go, oh, sorry, no, I understand. And to me, that would be brilliant. So, I talk about the book, the various versions of the robotic apocalypse, and I come to the conclusion after a good few pages of analysis that whilst it's very attractive for science fiction writers and movie makers, the chances of it happening are almost zero, I would imagine.
I bet they'll be in war. I mean, we've got drones now and stuff, but I mean actual robotic soldiers.
Yeah, I mean, we've already got that kind of stuff happening to a certain degree. I mean, you've got drone aeroplanes. You've got the other problem we might have is with ubiquitous surveillance using nanotechnology. That's a very real worry that people with a very, very
like
small
a little
robot
fly with a camera on.
Exactly, that kind of stuff. But again, with all these things, there's always an immune system that comes with it. So we worry, for instance, about internet privacy, but you can get a firewall, you can encrypt your stuff. People worry about nano surveillance. Well, you know, there will be a technology that allows you to, you know, detect if there's anything in your area or whatever. So there's always this kind of arms race between technology and the things that will protect you from it. And we've always had that, and we've always seemed to manage to do okay with it. But certainly warfare is going to become a lot more roboticized and computerized. I mean, one of the things I looked into with exoskeletons, where you can put this kind of robotic shell around a soldier, and now he can lift 200 pounds continuously without worrying about it, you know, for an hour at a time. Because he's got this exoskeleton, so you've got these super soldiers, which is this merging of robotic technology and human technology. That is, again, has brilliant implications for people who may be disabled, and now they can start to walk again with these technologies. But also, you can still use those technologies to increase the power of your warfare.
We'll be back in a moment with Mark Stevenson. We're going to take some of your calls next as we start that early on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Mark's in the United Kingdom, but he's coming to the United States for a book tour for An Optimist's Tour of the Future. If you are in the Washington, D.C. area listening to us on WMAL, he'll be there Feb 7 to the 8th. If you're in New York listening to us on WOR, Feb 9 to 10. San Francisco, KSFO, Feb 12 to 15. And in Seattle, Feb 16th, if you're listening to us on KIRO-FM. We'll be back in a moment with your calls and Mark Stevenson on Coast to Coast AM. Mark, do you think the world is changing too fast?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I think that in a way, we are not used to the pace of change, certainly. And I think one of the things I had to let go of was this idea that the world is a stable place. And I think there are certain ways of thinking about the future you have to embrace, and one of them is that change is the norm. And actually, that's okay. And we often worry about things changing too fast, but if you just look at what's happened in the last 20 years, I mean, think about it. The internet didn't exist 20 years ago. Most of us have got on board with that pretty easily. Our mobile phones have more processing power than the entire Apollo mission. And we handle this stuff pretty well. So we worry about handling change because it's ahead of us. But when it comes, we're generally pretty good at dealing with it, I think, on a personal level. So is it moving too fast? I don't know. I think we feel that. And certainly I felt that. But then if you begin to realize that every time a change comes as a society, we generally seem to be able to absorb it and handle it, then maybe we don't need to worry so much. But I do think you should be informed about the changes coming so you can make those decisions, you know, from a more informed perspective.
What is fueling the speed, the change?
Well, that's a great question. That one of the things that fuels the increasing speed of change is how innovation works, is that once you have invented one thing, it gives you a platform upon which to innovate again. So the internet is a very good example of this. Suddenly you're finding that people can communicate that didn't know each other before and mix ideas, and therefore they're able to create something much quicker than before. And you're seeing a process where information technology is invading lots of other disciplines. So we talked about genome sequencing earlier and how the cost of that is plummeting. And one of the reasons for that is because our computers are getting more and more powerful, which means our medicine gets more powerful. And there's a similar sort of trend happening in nanotechnology. And there's this idea I came across called autocatalysis, which is where things sort of basically goose each other into growth. So infotech, biotech, and nanotech are doing that. So it is something that we do as humans. We innovate, and as we innovate faster and quicker. And it's actually something that's essentially what we are as a people. So it's us that's driving it, and us through the technologies we're developing that's driving it. And it is getting ever faster. And that's again one of the worries I have with the way government works, because government, I don't know about you, seems to be getting ever slower at doing anything.
Absolutely. Let's go to some of the calls. John is in Walnut, California, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Mark. Hey, George.
Hey, John. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, basically, just want to let you guys know that when you're talking about the robots, that on February 14th, Jeopardy is going to have a robot versus two human contestants.
I bet the robot wins.
Well, I've already seen some video of this, and I think it's called Watson. I think it's from IBM, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Who's going to win there, Mark? What do you think?
I think it's going to be a fairly even match. The fact that we can now get a robot to do that is impressive. I mean, the thing you have to realize with this, people get scared about that kind of thing. Like, oh, God, you know, they're accelerating. But, you know, that's one area. You know, Watson, the robot that is going to probably, you know, impress us on Jeopardy, cannot, as I said earlier, you know, walk across a room, go out on a date, have a philosophical discussion like we're having now about, you know, the future. So you tend to find that AI or artificial intelligence works in constrained areas, and it is getting better and better and better in those areas. I mean, if you land at an airport, the whole scheduling system is basically an artificial intelligence. If you play a computer game, that's an artificial intelligence of a certain sort. But they're not general intelligences like you and I. They can't multitask in various different areas. So whilst that's very impressive, and it has lots of, you know, interesting implications, don't worry about the Matrix or the Terminator happening anytime soon.
But I do think one day, Mark, they're going to have robots that look so lifelike, that react, that they move. I mean, it's going to be scary.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And it might be scary or it might not. And it depends on how you view change and technology. So if we think that technology and robotics is a bad thing and we're scared of it, then we'll take it in that direction. So a good example, it's not a robotic example, but one I found myself using, is how we are often scared of technology ahead of it coming, and then when it starts working, we don't really mind. So IVF was a very good example of this. I don't know if you remember, but 20, 25 years ago, this was a massive controversy. People were saying, this is man playing God. We cannot possibly have these scientists fiddling with our sperm and our egg and creating human beings and test tubes. I mean, it's absolutely no way. Until it actually started working, and you had lots of cute kids running around and happy parents. And then you saw this very interesting flip where people started writing to their congressman to say, that became unethical not to have IVF. I really want that service. I want that. So it may be the case that as robots get better and better, you know, we may fear them and think, you know what, I actually would really like one of those robot servants. You know, I really like one of those guys to help me out with my homework. You know, it depends whether technology sucks or not, basically. And we worry about it sucking. But as it gets better and better, we tend to adopt it quite easily. And it may well be the case that in 100 years, we've got a robot and human society. I'm not going to predict that. But I think we've got plenty of time to negotiate it and steer it in a positive direction if we want to.
Brent in Auburn, California. First-time caller. Hi, Brent.
Hey, George. What's happening?
How are you?
All right. I'm calling in. I wanted to give kudos to your guest because for the past like 5 or 6 years, I've been listening to Coast to Coast and reading all the books that a lot of your guests have written. But at the same time, I've been studying the Bible, and I'm a Bible teacher to a certain degree. And what I'd like to say is that when I teach people about what's to come, people talk about the end. And I always tell them that, yeah, there's an end coming, but it's also a new beginning that's coming. And what the Word tells us is going to happen, and what a lot of your guests and what this guest is saying, yeah, some things that are coming up might not be that great, but if we're optimistic about what the outcome will be, that's the thing that we need to do spiritually and as a group consciously to be together when whatever's going to happen happens, and to be optimistic because we know the outcome's going to be, it's going to be positive. Positive always wins over negative because positive trusts positive. Yeah, negative knows, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it's really nice to hear you say that and bring the kind of the spiritual question in, because I cover that a bit in the book. I mean, the book is a lot about technology. But one of the things when we're talking about this rate of change and things getting faster and faster, which George has been talking about, I say that, we're going to face some very interesting philosophical questions. What it means to be human, what it means to be kind and compassionate, how do we maintain those values in a rapidly changing and innovating technological world? And at one point I say in the book, some people say that we're getting to this kind of post-spiritual world. And I kind of say, well, it might be that we need theologians even more, because these big philosophical questions are coming to us even faster. But the thing is, they're going to have to speed up, and our
absolutely.
Great spiritual things are going to have to speed up to keep
serious stuff.
Yeah, to keep pace. So they need to be informed as well. I mean, for instance, if you look at genetics, okay, there's a genetic code which every single, a genetic alphabet which every single animal, virus, human being, plant on the planet shares.
Yes.
We all share the same coding mechanism. Now, that has three possible conclusions. One, we're all evolved from the very first cell, okay? Two, that whenever life gets going, it somehow independently through some convergent process comes up with this way of coding, okay, for life. Or three, some divine creature, God, whatever you want to call it, gave it to us all. Okay, now for me, I don't care really which one of those you believe at the moment. What I am saying is this is what's happening in genetics and this is what we're doing with the code. So, you need to be informed, and that doesn't necessarily have to challenge your spiritual beliefs, but we must keep that golden rule that is in all religions across all the world, which is do unto others as you would do unto yourself, central. And the battle for people like Brent and the people he talks to is how do you keep that rule central in a rapidly evolving technological and culturally evolving world? And that's a question I think we have to battle with. And it's great to hear Brent talking like that. I think that's really, really positive.
Also, isn't it possible, Mark, that because things are going so quickly that we might not even be able to guess what the future might be in 10, 20 years?
Well, I don't make any predictions in the book precisely because of that point. I say these are the trends, these are the stuff that's, these trends will certainly interplay and there will be things that are coming, but I'm not going to make any concrete predictions. And I think that's true. I mean, the thing is, you can't predict your own personal life, more than a couple of weeks ahead. And I think
we'd like to,
right? And that's why things like, astrology is so popular and why we go to see, palmists and people like that who will, pretend to predict our future. But, the future is always uncertain because it hasn't happened yet. And I think you have to kind of make peace with that. And you just have to go, okay, based on where I am, I'm going to orientate myself in this direction. And when things change, I'm going to, take that on board rather than keeping to some, position that could have you in conflict with, either your partner or technology. You have to kind of go with the flow, and that's always scary. The past is easy for us because it went and we're still alive, so in general it went okay. The future, as always, we don't know what's around the corner, and that's a philosophical human problem that will never go.
Let's go to Ben in Billings, Montana. Hi Ben, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Okay, thank you.
Hey, I've been listening to this program for a long time, and I'm happy to talk to you, George.
Super.
Okay, I was just thinking, like, the way I'm half Iranian, and I've been over there, and I went over there in 1993, and I got to see a lot of, you know, what was the Sumerians and everything like that. And I just feel a connection, you know, sometimes. And me and my dad, you know, we have a similar political view, you know, and it's like we know that the New World Order is coming, you know.
It's out there.
It's out there. And it's inevitable, you know. And there's all we can do is stock up on our foods, you know, embrace ourselves.
Well, that's what we've been telling people for some time, Ben. You're absolutely right. Did you come across anybody, Mark, who looks into the future politically?
Well, I went to see Mohammed Nasheed, obviously, who's the president of the Maldives, so he definitely looks into the future politically. I think we've always had these fears that the future is that Armageddon is coming, that there is this kind of new world order, that there are some puppet masters that are going to change things for us. And the thing that gives me hope that that's not happening is if you look at any organization, you'll find that stupidity generally exhibits what is called a geometric progression rather than an arithmetic progression, especially in government. So three people who work for government are nine times as stupid as one. Okay, so the idea that there can be this new world order that coordinates things, I think, is very hard. Every time anybody's worked in government or works for a big organization, realize that they have difficulty coordinating anything, and in fact, they can't keep pace with the rapid change in technology. And what's good about the rapid advance of technology is a lot of these technologies mean that ordinary people have a lot more power in their hands. Now, that comes with some bad ideas as well, because that means ordinary people can have much more access to dangerous knowledge or weapons. But it also means that the average person can now fortify themselves or have access to knowledge and fortify their minds for a brighter future. So I'm not really convinced that the only Armageddon we're going to head for, I think, is if we don't know how to handle information. I do believe it's called the information age for a reason. If you do not know, if you can't tell the difference between the National Enquirer and a piece of peer-reviewed science, or you know, a newspaper editorial that comes from a particular political position and something that is just a neutral piece of reportage, if you can't understand the difference between those two things, you're going to be in trouble as an individual, as a family, as a corporation, as a government. It's an information age, and one of the things we are not teaching people at the moment, I'm very clear about this, is those critical thinking skills that allow us to make those judgments. I don't believe I was taught them at my school. I've had to learn them very painfully. I don't think a lot of our politicians certainly don't have them. So, you know, it is, how do you prosper in the information age? And it used to be that people would filter stuff for us. You know, we would have broadcasters, publishers, politicians who would say, this is the stuff you should look at. Here's a book. Like, you know, my book has been selected by a publisher to be published against the millions that are, you know, put out there. Broadcasters say, you should listen to this. Now, what we found is as we have more and more access to information is how bad, quite often, those people who have filtered it for us have been, what they've been hiding from us. So now we have this radical shift in our relationship with information. And if you're going to have mass publication, mass access to knowledge, you've got to have mass filtering, the ability for all of us to learn the sort of creative research skills that allow you to make optimum decisions based on evidence rather than opinion.
Was anybody concerned about the future that you talked to?
Yeah, I think everybody's concerned about the future, and that's why they're doing the things they are. I mean, they're all concerned about this narrative of the future that sort of Ben was espousing, that it's all going to go, you know, pretty badly wrong. And that they worry that that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy, a kind of a fait accompli. And all of them were very concerned. I talked to George Church about what's happening in synthetic biology, where you can begin to manipulate how cells work to, you know, on the one hand, do amazing things like produce new fuels very, very cheaply. But on the other hand, you know, maybe you can engineer a pathogen that can cause, you know, terrible harm. So these people, what I found very heartening was a lot of the scientists and thinkers, because they had also bought this idea that government was too slow to legislate ethically for this stuff, they were building their own legislative frameworks. And then the idea is that we will get government to rubber stamp them when we can, because these guys can't understand. So you're beginning to see this wealth of a kind of a collective consciousness, an ethical consciousness in science, which goes against the stereotype of the mad scientist who doesn't really care of the implications of the research. I have to say, I didn't find that. And the reason they're all in the future, doing the stuff that is because they do care about the future. They do want to put more power in the hands of ordinary people, like having your genome sequenced. Now you have your own genome. You can make decisions on your lifestyle, you know, to save yourself from a difficult or potentially life-threatening condition. You have access to the internet. You can find the information you need. What we need is the skills so that people can handle that. And that is the biggest threat, I think, is not any of these technologies per se, but the inability of people, if we don't teach them to be able to handle large amounts of information and filter it in a way that makes both ethical and intellectual sense.
Let's go to Jeff in New York City. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, George. Interesting show. Your guest raises really good points, but we got to get real here. The apprehension about the future with people, especially your audience, is critically linked to things like Monsanto and, I guess, the constant spraying of the skies in the genetically modified environment that is heading our way. That's the apprehension right there.
Hmm.
So what you're saying, Jeff, is you're worried that...
I'm not worried. It's a fact.
But what are you worried about?
I'm not worried.
You're not worried? So when you mention people like Monsanto, you're not worried about what they're doing?
No, I'm saying that's where the apprehension is coming from.
Yeah.
You're saying people should be more positive. It's like, well, it'd be nice, but look at what people are up against.
Well, exactly. And this goes back to my point about, this is why I wanted to write my book, okay, because I want to give people access to information so they can start to make informed decisions that are balanced. I am not saying the future is going to be great. I'm not saying it will necessarily be positive. I'm saying it could be, and everybody of good conscience has to be in that game. But you cannot be in that game unless you really know what's going on and you're informed and you have those critical thinking skills. So that's one of the reasons I run a learning agency. It's one of the reasons I run a science communication agency, because I think it's crucially important that people are able to sift opinion from fact and hold their legislators to account, who often make decisions based on emotion rather than evidence. So I think that you're right. We've got a huge battle ahead of us. And I was recently doing looking at the incidence of the words hope and fear across books from the last 500 years. And what you'll find is that if you go back several hundred years, the word hope was there a lot more often than the word fear. You get to 2000, and the instance of hope and fear is about the same. It's now starting to separate again, which is quite good. But we are fearful of the future, and I think part of that fear comes from not having the knowledge. So I absolutely agree with you. It's a big battle. I think I'm doing my bit to turn us more positive. I hope you are too.
We'll be back in a moment. We'll take more of your phone calls. I'd like for you possibly to predict the future. We'll get Mark to react as we talk an optimist tour of the future.